When President Obama threw out the first pitch at the All-Star game last night, he wore a Chicago White Sox jacket. He explained his wardrobe choice to Fox Sports commentator Tim McGarver.
Everybody knows I'm a White Sox fan, and my wife thinks I look cute in this jacket, so you know, between those two things, why not?
Why not?
Why not?
This wasn't Mr. Obama's first time on the mound. As an Illinois senator, he threw out the first pitch at Game 2 of the 2005 American League Championship between the White Sox and the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim.
They had just lost the first game, and after I threw out my pitch, they won 8 straight.
Those victories made the White Sox World Series champions. Whether the president is a good luck charm is an open question, but by a score of 4-3, the American League won again. It hasn't lost an All-Star game since 1996. It was a feel-good evening for baseball, though two of the game's biggest names were conspicuously absent. Here's our sports commentator, Frank DeFord.
Did you enjoy the All-Star game last night? Of course, it would have been just a whole lot better if Manny Ramirez and Alex Rodriguez were there. Hey, we want to see the real All-Stars, right? And what's a little thing like cheating and breaking the law to cut into our baseball fun? Really? That appears the way that most fans feel about the drug issue now. Alex Wolf wrote a fascinating piece last week for Sports Illustrated discussing how the European cycling culture is such that the continental fans pretty much accept the fact that the riders simply need drugs to compete. Likewise, by now, many baseball fans seem just to have been worn out by the drumroll of drug scandals. Well, we've even reached a point where performance-enhancing drugs are so common, they have a space-saving acronym now. Steroids and their like are just PEDs, PEDs. Sort of a cute little name, isn't it? Pets, pats, putt-putts, paws, peeps, PEDs. Almost sounds like a product. PEDs, PEDs Light, Diet PEDs. Hi, I'm Alex Rodriguez for PEDs. Did you have yours for breakfast this morning? Some of us players like our PEDs with strawberries or bananas. Others, like my good friend Manny Ramirez, liked his PEDs with female hormones. Or maybe in that wonderful phrase by the late Daniel Moynihan, the growing acceptance of PEDs is just the baseball version of defining deviancy down. It's the fashion now to defend the druggies by saying, hey, what's the big deal? Pitcher scuffed up balls. Team stole signs. Boys will be boys. What's a few PEDs among friends when you want to give 110%? When Ramirez returned to the Dodger lineup, he didn't even deign to talk about steroids. But anyway, by then it was as if poor Manny had been away on bereavement leave. ESPN covered his return to the minor leagues as a celebration, and yes, whereas WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, mandates 2 years if you're caught on drugs the first time, in baseball, it's only 50 games. And for your comfort and safety, you can come back early to the minors and get in shape for your grand resurrection back into the majors. Oh, a few old spoil sports still dare scold. Chris Young, the Padres pitcher and player representative, was there when Ramirez made his smirking return in San Diego, where cheering fans in the crowd wore replica Manny dreadlocks. It's shameful, Young said. And when, not to be outdone by ESPN, Fox cut into its regularly scheduled game to breathlessly show Manny's first return at bat, the analyst Tim McGarver had the courage to fume, why all the adulation for a guy who served a 50-game suspension? Why, Tim? Because we fans don't seem to care anymore, and the clean players cravenly accept their place as patsies. See you at the all-PED game next July.
Commentator Frank DeFord, he joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
I'm Steve Inskeep. Somehow we've made it through more than a year without another Harry Potter film in theaters, but finally the wait is over again. Our film critic Kenneth Turan says the latest film will make the fans happy.
The Half-Blood Prince begins with the dread Death Eaters on the march, threatening Hogwarts and all that it stands for. But don't let that fool you. The new Harry Potter film is as comfortable and reliable as an old shoe.
You are, of course, wondering why I brought you here tonight.
Actually, sir, after all these years, I'll just sort of go with it.
Take my arm.
The sixth picture in the series, Half-Blood Prince understands that it's not chills or suspense audiences are asking for here, but respectful familiarity. The Potter films are the modern exemplars of establishment movie making. We look to them for a level of craft, consistency, and most of all, fidelity to the originals, all of which we get. It's the phenomenal success of the books that's made all this possible. They've created an audience that has invested so much emotion, not to mention time, in the Potter saga that skipping a movie episode is out of the question. That's a kind of brand loyalty that's all but gone out of style. That investment of time also means that we've been watching the film's youthful principals, Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and Emma Watson, grow up on screen since 2001. They've become as familiar as family members, and Half-Blood Prince trades on that to keep us involved when an emphasis on the agonies of teenage romance slows things down.
What you see before you is a curious little potion. It does cause powerful infatuation or obsession.
I'm in love with her.
All right, fine, you're in love with her. Have you ever actually met her?
Can you introduce me?
Fortunately, there's more to Half-Blood Prince than youthful heartache. Evildoers scheme dark schemes, and Harry has serious tasks of his own to attend to. Hearts Across America will beat faster when Michael Gambon's Dumbledore says to Harry, as only he can, "Once again, I must ask too much of you."
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the LA Times, and he is not the only one giving a thumbs up to the new Harry Potter film.
The Vatican newspaper is also giving the film its blessing. Last year, the paper called Harry Potter the, quote, wrong model of a hero. But in a review yesterday, it said the latest film was the best in the series. The reviewer wrote that the film reaches the right balance with a clear line between good and evil. You can judge for yourself. Watch clips at NPR.org.
I am Willie Brown. I am formerly the mayor of San Francisco and formerly the speaker of the California State Assembly for 15 years.
For decades, Willie Brown was California politics. He is today's California character, our series on Californians who in some way embody the Golden State. Willie Brown spent more than 30 years in the State Assembly. He was the first African-American Assembly Speaker and the longest serving and probably the most powerful. He dubbed himself the Ayatollah of the Assembly. Then he became San Francisco's first Black mayor. He's known for his political savvy, his larger-than-life personality, and his sense of style. Lots of expensive hats and Italian suits. Willie Brown joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, what hat are you wearing today?
I'm wearing a Panama. It's summertime, and it's just appropriate to celebrate with that kind of a hat.
What are you celebrating?
Life itself. At 75 years of age, I celebrate every day.
Excellent. Well, you are retired now, but if you could, shall we say, put on your figurative hat and pretend you're still Speaker of the Assembly, why is it that California can't get an agreement through, pass a budget, and work its way out of this massive deficit? What do you say to people who are watching this and wondering what's different about California politics?
California is burdened with a two-thirds vote requirement, and California is burdened with something called term limits. In a democracy, it works best when people get to know each other and when, in some cases, people with superior information and knowledge on certain subject matters are, in fact, looked to for advice and counsel. You don't have any of that in Sacramento. And then when you have the additional item of requiring two-thirds votes, you leave the tyranny of the process completely to an irresponsible third of the people. And that can be destructive, as is the case in the state of California. Eliminate term limits, get rid of the initiatives, do something about the two-thirds, and you will not have the stalemate that you currently have in the state capitol.
Now, you mentioned term limits. Those term limits were put in place largely because of you, because you were serving more than 15 years as Assembly Speaker.
Well, there clearly were objections by some people to my longevity. They couldn't beat me simply because I actually did the job that you need to do, and my colleagues continuously reelected me. You can only hold it, if you please, every day, 40 other people or more. I did that better than anyone who had ever, ever been speaker, and probably as well as anyone who will do it in the future. I did it, and I would still be speaker today without the advent of term limits.
Some people said that the term limits were put in place because it was a way of cleaning house, that when you have politicians such as yourself in office for long periods of time, cronyism creeps in, corruption may creep in, and in fact, you were investigated for many years by the FBI for corruption, never charged, never convicted. And you once said, you were quoted in an article as saying, this is politics. You punish your enemies and reward your friends.
I don't know of any other way to govern in a democracy except to build a consensus. And you build a consensus with those people who, one, believe in you, two, who follow your advocacy, and three, who have the same commitment you have to doing what needs to be done to achieve a goal. Some people may call it cronyism. Some people may call it deal-making. Some people may call it working with your friends. Let me tell you, in a democracy, that's what you need to do.
You were Speaker of the Assembly. You were in Sacramento for more than 30 years. You were San Francisco mayor for two terms. If you could point to one single accomplishment in all those years in public service as your proudest moment, what would it be?
There would never be an occasion when I could point to only one thing in the almost 40 years of my holding public office.
But what about accomplishments in terms of legislative achievements?
That's too many in 40 years. There's no single.
Pick one. Just one you really like.
No,
just one.
There could never be one. There never could be just one. You'd have to take my career year by year, and in some cases, month by month. I don't think you could find anything that would singularly reflect the true nature of a 40-year career at my level.
You grew up in Texas, but you've lived in California for most of your life. And in fact, you are synonymous with California politics. I'm wondering, what does California mean to you? When you say I'm a Californian, what does that mean to you?
California afforded me the opportunity to have a career in the world of public service. This is a nation state. This is a place in which every kind of activity one may wish to engage in can be engaged in. Every aspect of what one would hope to be exposed to worldwide is virtually available here in California. You really don't have to leave to achieve, to indulge, or to experience. That's what California means to me.
Willie Brown, longtime political power broker in California, now trying to groom the next generation of California politicians at the new Willie L. Brown Jr. Leadership Center at San Francisco State University. Willie Brown, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
And to see photos of Willie Brown and just a few of the hats in his collection, go to our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Obama wants more Americans to go to college. He's been urging people to pursue at least a year of education beyond high school, and yesterday he unveiled a plan to help more students graduate from community colleges. Mr. Obama and others say that most of the jobs now being created require at least a two-year college education. Some experts, though, are challenging that notion, as NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The president's visit to Macomb Community College in Warren, Michigan, was the perfect backdrop for his message. This community is reeling from auto industry job losses, and many are anxious to know what new jobs, if any, are on the horizon.
We'll fund programs that connect students looking for jobs with businesses that are looking to hire.
Community colleges, Mr. Obama said, are an essential part of the nation's economic recovery.
We know that in the coming years, jobs requiring at least an associate degree are projected to grow twice as fast as jobs requiring no college experience. We will not fill those jobs or even keep those jobs here in America without the training offered by community colleges.
In the audience was Jamie Mirasotis, president of the Lumina Foundation and a longtime advocate of what the president is proposing, college access for all.
What I like about the president's plan is that it recognizes that not everybody needs a bachelor's degree. Some people need an associate degree. Some people simply need a certificate or a credential that will allow them to be successful in the workforce.
Mirasotis says Mr. Obama is endorsing what many education experts believe, that jobs, now more than ever, will require at least a 2-year college degree. Not true, though, says Richard Vedder, economics professor at Ohio University.
A huge percentage of our nation's human capital is created in on-the-job training, not through formal schooling in any case.
Vedder has spent the last 44 years teaching economics and writing about the connection between higher education and the labor force. He says he's been wary of Mr. Obama's higher education agenda ever since the president told a joint session of Congress that every American should pursue some form of education beyond high school.
When I heard that, I was somewhat shocked because I think it's an impossible dream.
Not everybody has the interest, the ability, or the need to pursue a college degree, says Vedder. And more to the point, the government's own data shows that most of the new jobs Mr. Obama talks about may require some kind of training, but not a college education.
It doesn't take a huge amount of skills to be a bartender, for example. It doesn't take a lot of skills to work in fast food places, in retail trade, and so on. These are not always high-paid jobs, but not everyone in America can have a job that pays above the average.
Vedder says, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, only 5 of the 25 fastest-growing occupations over the next decade require any kind of college degree. The rest include jobs like office clerks, home care and health aides, janitors and maids. Not exactly the nursing or green technology jobs Mr. Obama highlighted in his speech. Vedder says the president is cherry-picking his data. Still, Jamie Mirasotis of the Lumina Foundation insists the president's plan is the right approach.
A dramatic increase in the number of Americans with college credentials is absolutely essential for our economic, social, and cultural development as a country. It's an audacious goal, however.
It's the higher education equivalent of a moonshot, says Mirasotis. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
General Motors and Chrysler have survived, but they're a lot smaller now. Nearly 24 auto plants have closed, and that's put many cities in a quandary. How to recycle the buildings and the land around them? They could look to Anderson, Indiana, as an example. As NPR's Cheryl Corley reports, it was once home to about 20 General Motors plants.
One of the first cities that may seek a little help from Anderson, Indiana, is Fenton, Missouri, just outside of St. Louis. That's where workers built the Dodge Ram pickup truck until Chrysler shut the plant down last week. Jeff Esmeyer was one of the last workers on the assembly line.
Got no job. 14 years and no job. I don't know what I'm going to do now.
Chrysler had already shut down its minivan plant in Fenton late last year. Mayor Dennis Hancock says the city at work to diversify its economy in anticipation of possible closures. Even so, says Hancock, losing the plants is still a psychological blow.
When I drive by those plants today, it's almost eerie to see the empty parking lots that either used to be full of vehicles that belonged either to the employees or that were produced there. Now it's just an empty sea of asphalt.
In all, 21 Chrysler and GM plants are to close permanently or be idled over the next few years. It can mean a substantial loss of tax revenue in addition to thousands of jobs. What cities get in return, initially, is a massive vacant auto plant.
It was a huge hit for us.
That's Chris Ackerman, the mayor of Anderson, Indiana, which is located near Indianapolis. Anderson used to be the land of auto workers, and General Motors was king with 25,000-plus employees on the GM payroll. Times were good, but the auto industry heyday started to fade as early as the late 1970s for Anderson. Eventually, thousands would lose their jobs, and the mayor now says there's not a single active GM plant here.
And we've managed to survive it. We've managed to keep that positive outlook and keep that positive energy of returning maybe different types of industry back to our community to keep us afloat.
Part of Anderson's survival came from getting rid of a number of its old GM plants. Linda Dawson, the city's director of economic development, says more than a dozen factories were torn down and the land was cleaned up for new development.
Community struggles with that concept because it also reduces the tax base. But most of these plants that were built in the 40s and 50s do not meet modern standards, and there's no value in them. There's no market to them.
Several of Anderson's former GM plants were sold and are now occupied by other companies. During a driving tour, Tammy Bowman, the city spokeswoman, points to one of the buildings. It's about 900,000 square feet and used by several tenant companies.
They do it with shared dock space. I believe they share a fork truck. And it's just a new way of looking at an old building.
Using the proceeds from the sale of another GM property, along with state and federal funds, Anderson created its flagship Enterprise Center to help startup businesses. The director, Dwayne Landwehr, says there's been a spinoff of more than 50 companies, including the Bright Automotive Group.
The company itself is developing a delivery van that gets 100 miles to the gallon,
which fits right in the city's efforts to attract green businesses. Production on the hybrid van is scheduled to begin in 2012. Landwehr says it's an exciting prospect, but the center's focus is not the automotive industry.
These businesses that we are bringing in that are 2, 3, 4 employees, 10 employees, those are the kinds we really want. Because if one goes out, you know, it's not a devastating event for the community.
Anderson's largest employer now is the city's hospitals. 2 years ago, food processor Nestle's built a massive plant here. Still, signs of the auto industry devastation linger. Two vacant GM plants remain part of the city's landscape. Gary McKinney, who oversees the cleanup of Anderson's industrial sites, says Plant 16, an older facility, hasn't been used for years.
And with a little investment, it would be a great building for someone. It just would need to be the right company.
Then there's Plant 20, which Anderson officials call a jewel. It's newer, with high ceilings and vast floor space. At least three companies are interested in retrofitting the plant, and Anderson is in serious negotiations with one. Variety Global Business Group, a Chinese firm, wants to manufacture an environmentally friendly alternative to styrofoam. James Dixon is a minister who encouraged the firm to visit his hometown.
And even if a company can't use the 600,000 square feet facilities or the 2 million square feet facilities that GM left as skeletons across America, what we can do is section off parts of it.
Anderson, Indiana may still have more to do to recover from years of automotive dependency, but business and government leaders say they've created a good blueprint for communities faced with recycling old auto plants and huge tracts of vacant industrial land. Cheryl Corley, NPR News.
Next, we'll hear from a leading insurance company, one of many opposed to the so-called public option. That's the plan for a government health insurance program to compete with private insurance. We sat down with Dr. Sam Nussbaum, Chief Medical Officer for WellPoint. What's wrong with a public plan?
Steve, we do not endorse a government-run health plan. We absolutely want to see universal coverage for all Americans. We believe the private sector can provide innovative solutions to healthcare.
Dr. Nussbaum influences coverage received by WellPoint's 35 million customers. It is the country's largest health benefits firm. He argues that the private sector is more efficient than the government.
Let me give one specific example, Steve, that I think will be informative. When we look at advanced imaging, and this is MRI, CAT scan, PET scans, we know that as much as 30% of those procedures are not necessary. And we've been able, over the last several years, to have growth in imaging procedures of between 0 and 5%. The government under CMS has seen imaging grow 15% to 20% a year during the same time interval.
You're talking about Medicare payments, Medicare program.
The Medicare program. I'm talking about the use of imaging services and the cost of imaging services. So I would argue that where the private sector has been far more effective than government programs is in limiting clinical services to those that are best meeting the needs of patients. Important as Medicare is for coverage for Americans, it has not been effective in controlling cost, in integrating care, and bringing the advances in medical treatment to all Americans.
There are people who would argue with you about the effectiveness of Medicare or the efficiency of Medicare. I'll take the point that you have a different perspective on that, but I would just ask if you're not undermining your own argument. If the government is lousy at providing efficient health care, why is a public health plan a threat to you? You'll just be more efficient than they are and make money.
I believe we will be far more efficient than a government program. I think
then why worry about it? Why not just let them establish it and you won't lose any customers to them?
Here's the issue, Steve, is that we're talking about competition not on a level playing field. The government can negotiate very different for healthcare costs. They can basically set unit cost reimbursement. They today set unit cost reimbursement approximately 20% below that paid by the private sector.
Let me just translate that. You're saying that if a hospital provides a service, it's covered by insurance. Medicare, for example, would pay 20% less than WellPoint would pay for a patient with the same service.
Exactly. On average, the private sector subsidizes government programs by approximately 20%.
Oh, when you say subsidizing, you're arguing that that hospital makes up the shortfall for Medicare by charging you a little bit more.
Absolutely. It's the hidden tax, the hidden cost shift.
Given that lots of lawmakers are insisting on a public plan of some kind, but there's still some flexibility as to what kind of plan it would be, is there any form of a public plan or a government plan that you think WellPoint can accept and live with?
We've talked about the fact that a government plan is not necessary to achieve the insurance market reform, the delivery system reform, that is so necessary for Americans. We do not believe there is any need for a government plan.
But I'm asking, given the political realities of the situation, if somebody says to you and says, okay, look, we know you don't like it, but tell us what you can live with. Is there anything you can live with in this department?
I think we have to look at the plans that exist today that are viewed as being government plans. The Federal Employees Health Benefit Program, that's a plan that is managed, that is run, that has all of the advantages of a private health insurance plan. And we at WellPoint are proud to provide benefits for 1.3 million federal employees under that program.
I mean, it sounds like you're basically saying, look, we just don't want a government-run health plan. We're just not going to sign on to that.
That's correct. However, I think the American people need to understand that even the government health plan that has been most highly regarded, the government health plan that our senators and our congressmen and our president has access to, is actually a plan run by the private sector.
Dr. Nussbaum, one other question. Our correspondent, Mara Liasson, had a report last week that focused on the language that politicians use. For example, when President Obama talks about someone who is working with him, he'll describe that person as a stakeholder, whereas if they're working against the White House's agenda, they're a special interest. I'm wondering if right now you think you're a stakeholder or a special interest.
That's a terrific question, Steve. I'd like to believe that we are a stakeholder, that we are collaborating strongly to produce and share our knowledge to produce health reform that is sustainable, that produces high-quality health care, that makes the health care experience for all Americans as terrific as the clinical science and innovation that we have in America.
Dr. Sam Nussbaum is Chief Medical Officer for WellPoint. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Steve.